Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network, and it's time to take a look at the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Couple of guests for you. They come by every 2 months, as a matter of fact, to talk about wildlife. One of them, David Drake, is in the studio with me, a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. David, good to see you again.
Good to see you as well, Larry. Thank you.
With us by phone today, Jamie Knack. Jamie is a UW Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Jamie, with us by phone. Jamie, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Larry.
What the heck are you doing away from the studio?
Yeah, what are you doing?
Yeah, what am I doing, right? So I am at the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation this week, and that is in Dundee, Illinois. And I am an instructor and mentor for a week-long course for natural resource professionals to learn more about hunting awareness and some conservation education. So we've got a group of, about a dozen instructors and about 20 natural resource professionals from state and federal agencies across the country here taking a week-long workshop with us.
You didn't drag Scott Craven along with you, did you?
He happens to be here. I tried to get him to join me on the radio, but he is attending to some other important stuff.
Listen, Jamie does not have an easy time overseeing Craven. She is the one who has to sit Craven right now, and that is not an easy task. Trust us.
Well, let's turn from what you're up to and what Scott Craven is up to what the wildlife have been up to. We had some pretty extreme temperatures last week. Normally, animals are able to handle short periods, I would think.
Yeah, I think it was certainly not pleasant. I was out quite a bit during the entire polar vortex for a variety of reasons, to walk my dog or whatever the other case might be. And you know, you bundle up and you it's not miserable. But animals are very adapted to this, especially if they're going to stay up here for the wintertime and be active during the wintertime. But they're very adaptable. You know, if you're a mammal, you've got a pretty thick coat on your body, and that's a nice thing to have on. Animals like birds, you know, they've got a high metabolism, so they run pretty hot to begin with. As long as they can continue to find food and replace the energy or calories they're burning to stay warm, then they're going to be just fine. And animals will do a whole bunch of other things too. Obviously they'll get out of the wind so that they're not it's not as cold. If the sun's out, even though it's might be a bitterly cold day, if they're out of the wind but in the sun, they're absorbing solar radiation, so that will help them stay warm. There are certainly microclimates, or what we call microclimates, so that they may go and just bed down in a cattail marsh or in a thick vegetation,
sure.
and that acts as kind of a blanket for them. And then obviously if we have snow on the ground, you've got small mammals that are what we call subnivium. So they're underneath the snow, and that snow is actually very warm. It's like an insulating blanket. So animals, if you're going to stay up in the north and you're going to obviously experience cold periods like this off and on, and you better be adapted for it. And all the animals that are up here are adapted. So the ones that were active, they can survive these, especially short bursts of very cold weather like that. Other animals take the strategy of getting the heck out of Dodge and going south, where it's much warmer. So, the humans do that, are called snowbirds. And yet then you've got other animals that might be hibernating. So they just sleep through the winter, and that's their strategy to endure the cold, and we'll be waking up hopefully in the next month or two.
And, Jamie, to turn to you for just a second, well, we have some temperature or some weather here in Wisconsin and some parts of the state, at least, where we're getting rain and it's turning to icy rain. That might even be worse than the polar vortex.
Yeah, that's really true. And especially when we talk about reptiles and amphibians that hibernate below the ground, it's that snow that's really important. So actually years when we have really cold temperatures but without that insulating snow layer, we get pretty concerned about how deep that frost is going to go in the ground and what impact it may have on some of those species as well. So another thing I always like to point out when we talk to folks, and there's always concern when it's so cold, how are animals handling these temperatures? And of course, David mentioned they're adapted to survive in the wild, of course. But it's also a really good time to point out what you as a person or a landowner can do to provide that habitat. So it's the shelter and the cover and then access to native foods. And in many cases, if you're feeding through a bird feeder to keep up the supplement of food that you're providing. But things like maintaining or hanging on to some of the dead trees, the snags for roosting cover, the conifers for the thermal cover, and then planting native trees and shrubs. I know, you know, by me, we've still got, you know, birds really relying heavily on some of the crab apples and fruits that are hanging on to some of the trees nearby. So it's actually something we can be proactive about and do some of that management in the proactively, and that wildlife will do just fine when we get to these points in the late winter.
Yeah, that's a good point. The other thing, Jamie, along those lines, I'm glad you mentioned that, is, you know, a lot of people want to clean their gardens up in the fall, and they will take all the old growth out and cut it down and get rid of it. But if you can leave your garden standing and clean it in the spring, that old growth actually will provide some thermal cover for animals. There might be some seeds left in those plants that you've got in your garden, and that can provide some food source and things like that. So don't clean your garden up until the springtime. That will also help wildlife.
Yeah, we've had juncos just like, you know, just crazy the last couple of weeks here in our old perennial beds where we left that dead grasses standing. So they've been in there foraging.
Yeah. Well, we have some callers online. By the way, if you have a question, comment, maybe an experience to share, you can certainly join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, Chris and Adams has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I have a comment about the previous caller, and the birds almost ate me out of house and home when it was so cold outside. I had to refill my feeders like 5 times a day. But my parents used to throw, I don't get a Christmas tree anymore, but my parents used to throw their Christmas tree on its side out in the snow in the backyard, and we had pheasants in there one year.
Yeah.
So that's just one way to not have to deal with it when it's winter. You can just throw it out, and then when it gets brown and crunchy, you can deal with it otherwise. I wanted to know what you guys think about the animal killing contests that are going on in the state, and it's not just coyotes. They're killing all kinds of things. And I wanted to let people know that Senator Fred Risler is putting through a bill to outlaw and regulate these situations, and anybody that's interested can call his office one way or another and support the bill or not support the bill, and there probably will be a hearing once he gets to committee. And so we're trying to get a whole pile of people to go down to Madison and appear for this because in my mind, this is bloodlust. It's despicable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you, Chris, very much for calling. Well, let's go to Jamie. Jamie, you want to comment?
Sure. So, I mean, by law in Wisconsin, and I believe what you're talking about are some of the coyote contests, and I don't really have direct knowledge of some of those to know how they're framed up, so I need to be a little careful how specific I get or...
Yep.
You know, not having that background, but the goal, I am guessing, is to reduce some of those populations of predators that are perceived to have an impact on perhaps deer or other wildlife populations. So whether that's founded or unfounded, we certainly have predation. We certainly have fewer trappers and hunters on the landscape for some of those species. But you know, as far as the contest side of things, I think they're, again, using that to just draw the interest and increase that harvest. But, again, I'm really not real tuned into how that's being advertised and promoted and so on. But, I mean, that's the intent.
Yeah, I just had a conversation with a friend of mine about this bill, as a matter of fact, yesterday. And so I, you know, obviously, when you're trying to promote a bill, you're gonna portray the worst of the worst, and that's one of the things that's coming out of some of the, of this bill. And I think it's a good conversation to have about these animal killing contests. You know, as Jamie says, one of the reasons that you're allowed to bait certain animals or use hounds or whatever the case, maybe these killing contests is, it is a way to put additional harvest pressure on a species that might be growing, their population is growing faster than you can actually regulate the population growth. And so it is a tool if used properly. I think, you know, my concern about these killing contests is just number one, that I think the name of it, a killing contest, is a bit of a, you know, just it just doesn't sound very good. The other issue is, I mean, as long as it's done legally and ethically and there's some sustainability to it, I think is good. But a lot of times, too, especially with coyote contests, you know, they're not necessarily using the pelt for some and some are and some aren't. I mean, I don't want to generalize here, but the issue I have, if you're going to have some type of a contest like this, and it could be rattlesnake roundups down in Texas or Oklahoma or coyote killing contests up here in Wisconsin, you know, a lot of that resource goes to waste. And that's what bothers me, I think, about this, is that if you're going to actually harvest an animal, use as much of that animal as you possibly can. If you're just going to kill a coyote and either hang it on your fence or just to kill a coyote and let it sit in the field, that to me is wrong. And that really does go against our model, North American model of conservation. One of the seven tenets in the North American model of conservation is, if you're going to harvest something, use it. And I know that this becomes an emotional issue for a lot of people, and I'm sure that this is going to draw a lot of people to Madison for this bill. So it'd be something to kind of keep an eye on.
Let's take some more calls. Kim in Rosendale has something for us next. Hi, Kim.
Hi, good morning. Well, last week Tuesday, so it was the day before it got really, really cold, I have a spring-fed creek in my backyard, so it's always open water, there's watercress, I get a lot of birds, and I had a kingfisher in my backyard.
Oh, nice.
And I not only got the call on tape, but I got the bird on tape. I know it was a kingfisher, and I looked it up, and they migrate. I have no idea what that bird was doing back there. And I was monitoring for 2 days to see if it would come back, and I didn't see it Wednesday and Thursday. But, I mean, is that completely abnormal for a kingfisher to be around in winter?
And then right in the polar vortex.
Yes.
Time period.
So to answer your question, no. And, in fact, I had been reading, I believe I had seen it through the DNR's outdoor report, a more detailed report, that there were some... You know, they always kind of summarize unusual sightings or rare sightings or some of the migratory species as they're moving through. And there was a couple notes that some kingfishers had still been being seen. And what you have is you have open water and still the ability for them to find that food. And I do not doubt you, because they are very unique in the way they look and certainly there's the sound that they produce. So the polar vortex might have been enough to continue to push that bird further south, but a lot of times they don't go any further south than they have to find the resources that they need.
Yeah, as long as there's open water, they'll stick around. As a matter of fact, our department does a Christmas bird count route here in Madison, maybe a couple weeks before Christmas time, and usually we pick up at least one belted kingfisher on our route. You know, at least mid December. So as long as they've got fresh water and open water, I shouldn't say fresh water necessarily, but open water, they'll stick around for sure. And the species we have is belted kingfisher, and they're you can't confuse them with much else, because they've got this bluish body, white collar around the neck, and kind of an abnormally sized head relative to their body.
Yeah.
They're neat birds.
Kim, you had a good experience there. Thanks. Appreciate it. Appreciate your call. Let's take another call. Tim in New Berlin, it's your turn now. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Thanks. Can you tell me what impact, if any, the polar vortex will have on hopefully suppressing deer ticks? Uh-huh. This summer, and do you know of any legislation that's being discussed, or any, you know of any action from Madison that might be on the horizon regarding trying to control CWD, chronic wasting disease?
Okay,
Jamie, I'll take the tick question if you want to take CWD.
I'll
take the easier one. So in terms of the polar vortex and ticks, Ticks along with mites or any other ectoparasite, typically we need a much more sustained cold than just 2 or 3 days or even 2 weeks of a polar vortex type cold. Even though those were record cold temperatures, it was not sustained long enough to really diminish the tick population. So, you know, the last couple of winters, at least down in the southern part of the state here, the last couple of winters have been pretty mild, and we've seen a lot of mange, for example, in some of the fox and coyote populations, and I know some of the tick populations have been, pretty healthy because we haven't had a sustained enough cold in the wintertime to really kind of control or knock that population down. So I guess the time, we still have a couple of months left of winter, and it really is going to depend on what the next couple of months look like. But we've had a pretty, at least again in the southern part of the state, we've had a pretty mild winter up to about the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and I had P.J. Leash from the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the show, just sort of a related, somebody called about emerald ash borer. Would we have killed off the emerald ash borer? And his response to that was, you know, you might have killed a few, but
yeah.
they're not going to go away.
And if you're interested in this, Tim, if you want to Google Midwest Center for Excellence, vector-borne diseases, I think it is. And so there's a big grant that Susan Paskowitz and some of her colleagues in the Department of Entomology here on campus got, and they study vector-borne diseases relative to ticks and mosquitoes in particular. And if you look at their website, they probably will update some of that information relative to ticks.
All right. Tim, thank you. Wait a minute. We've got
CWD.
CWD. Almost forgot about that. Jamie, Nack?
Yeah, so Tim, you were kind of asking if there's any legislation or movement on the forefront here with chronic wasting disease. And I think with some changes in terms of a new governor, a new secretary for the Department of Natural Resources, a new makeup of the Natural Resources Board, we may see some movement in that direction. I also expect them to, discussions and where we stand on climate change and what directions we might go there, I think, are another topic that'll get revisited. But last year we had a proposed legislation that was then, it came up pretty quick to the deer hunting season. So I think folks were having a difficult time dealing with logistics of it, but that pertained to carcass movement and transportation once deer are harvested. I think that is something that might be revisited. And certainly, as far as testing, I mean, we definitely want to continue to encourage folks and really push them, motivate them to have their deer tested before they consume any meat from a deer harvested in that affected area.
There we go. Thank you so much for that, for those questions, Tim. Appreciate it very much. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and the University of Wisconsin Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife today here in Wisconsin with our guests, David Drake and Jamie Nack. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Questions for them, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, we got an email from with a photo, and I'm trying to get it lined up here. Todd in Delavan emailed a photo of his tree with a bunch of scratches toward the bottom, wondering what the heck could have caused those. Those occurred maybe a few months ago.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the picture myself here. Jamie, I'll take this one. It looks like a scratch, but the things that would scratch a tree, especially if you said it's occurred over the last couple months, most of the things that would scratch a tree are hibernating right now. So I would think maybe a groundhog possibly would do something like that. You know, not down in Delavan, we wouldn't have bears, but sometimes you'll get black bears scratching on trees. Bobcats will do that, and bobcats are active year-round. But to me, it looks like maybe the tree has gone through a freeze-thaw process, and
well,
the tree
yeah.
is actually frozen and then kind of is busted open based on the way that the wood fiber is kind of ripped there.
Yeah.
So I think that's what actually is going on, Tim, is more of a freeze-thaw process. I don't believe that it's wildlife actually scratching the tree. But if you want, maybe call a certified arborist in your area and have them come out and take a look at the tree and see if they will confirm that it is a freeze-thaw process going on. And if not, then you can find my name or Jamie's name on the internet and send us the picture back with some additional information, and we'd be glad to take another look at that.
Let's go to Sean in Hudson next. Hi, Sean.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Yes, I'm curious if your guests know where the antler drop is in Wisconsin for whitetail. I had heard earlier that it was a mild winter, so they're holding onto their antlers longer. But with that polar vortex, I was curious if that had any effect of speeding it up or slowing it down, or if it had any effect at all.
Jamie, you want to take
this? Yeah, this is Jamie. Great question. I only have, like, anecdotal, my own personal sightings. I've seen a little bit of both right now where antlers have already fallen off. I've also been looking at trail camera photos, and there's still some antlers on. As you know, the heavier the antler, the easier it is for it to shed, so you might see spikes and yearlings hang on to their antlers a bit longer. As far as how the temperature would impact that, I'm at a loss. There might be others listening that have read articles and are more into shed hunting than I, but for me, it's just anecdotal at this point.
I think a lot of that also is driven by the amount of daylight, you know, and so obviously, you know, a lot of, be it an animal's reproductive cycle or migratory cycle or whatever the case might be, the primary driver, a lot of that is the amount of daylight, and that's what kind of drives their hormonal system. And obviously the hormonal system was driving antler growth for males. And so as you get shortened days and less daylight, then our weather changes. So we have, it typically is colder. We get different weather patterns in terms of precipitation or moisture and things like that. But a lot of that is driven by the amount of daylight, not necessarily whether or not we're getting cold weather. Although cold weather is obviously associated with shorter days, but you know, like the polar vortex doesn't necessarily have anything to do with day length. It has more to do with, you know, some larger climactic situations going on.
All right, Sean, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Valerie in Muscadet, it's your turn. Hi, Valerie.
Hi there. I have a couple questions about coyotes and then a request. We have never had coyotes be so bold as they have been in this last week on our farm. Like at 10 o'clock this morning, two of them were on our septic mound right outside our back door. And I wonder if that's because they're starving or if they're, because it's mating season. I don't know if all the rabbits are dead or whatever, and they're trying to pick off cats. Second question, do they mate for life? And then my request is, both of you have referred to harvesting when really what's happening is killing. Harvesting is an agricultural term, so there is no deer harvest. There's deer killing, there's coyote killing, and I just ask you to think about language.
Well,
thanks for calling, Valerie, by the way.
Jamie, David? I'll take a stab at this and have you weigh in as you want. This comes up regularly on this program, is the harvest versus killing, and we've talked about this a number of times. So, you know, we use harvest because harvest is it connotes that there's a research-based, sustainable take to that harvest. And we could be arguing semantics. We could call it calling. We could call it killing. We could call it harvesting. We could call it euthanasia. I mean, it's all the same thing. You're killing an animal. I get that. But we do typically tend to kind of focus more on the harvest because it is – there is research-based, there's research behind bag limits or what the season limit is, and it is a sustainable practice. Just like harvesting crops, there's a sustainable practice to that. And if you look at Aldo Leopold's game management book back in the 1930s, he talks about raising wildlife populations just like agricultural crops, and harvesting them in a sustainable manner. So we don't mean to belittle the fact that animals are getting killed by any stretch of the imagination. To us, from a scientific and a conservation standpoint, harvest is the more appropriate term, especially if it's being done ethically and sustainably.
I would say, just to add to that, harvest also implies that you're then using the animal that you kill. And so that's how I've always, if I'm thinking of harvesting, I'm thinking of, I might kill an animal, but I'm going to use the animal.
Yeah.
I'll eat the animal.
Jamie, do you want to add anything before we turn to the coyotes?
What you've both shared is exactly what I would have shared. The only thing to add, you know, for me personally as a hunter, killing is a very small part of the process of hunting. And harvest to me is a term that more encompasses the entire process of hunting, just like you grow a garden or raise a crop. You've got the land management, and there's, you know, more to be done, the cooking, the eating of the game and everything. So harvest is why I choose that term, but the outcome is the same. The animal is dead.
Yeah, the animal is killed.
Yep. All right, so for the coyotes, they too typically mate for life. So you'll have, obviously, coyotes live in a pack, and then you'll typically have a dominant male and a dominant female who are, they're the only two that actually breed within that pack. And so as long as the dominant male and dominant female are still alive and able to breed, then they will continue to reproduce within that pack system. And as to why the coyotes are showing up in your septic mound, it is breeding season for the coyotes right now. So that may or may not have something to do with it. What I suspect is more likely is that those two coyotes, especially being seen during the day like that, is that they're around human beings, and they've habituated or gotten used to human beings. And so as they get used to human beings and being in human dominated landscapes and within human presence, and nothing bad happens to them, then they start to lose their fear of human beings. So the very best thing you can do when you see something like that, and tell this to everybody in your community as well, because everybody has to do this for it to be maximize the effectiveness of it. But we tell people to go, you know, enjoy watching those animals, because it, just like any wildlife, I mean, the wildlife are they're phenomenal things to watch generally. But after you get a chance to watch those animals from a safe distance, then you should scare them or haze them by either poking your head out the door and yelling, go away, or banging pots and pans, or putting some pebbles or pennies in a pop can and rattling it, or using a whistle or air horn or something like that. But make some loud noise to scare or haze the coyotes. And the proper response from the coyotes is that they should move away from you upon that noise. And if they don't, then you need to be a little bit more aggressive about your hazing technique. If they still don't move away after a number of repeated times, call either your police department or your county wildlife department, natural resources, Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources wildlife biologist in your county, and let them know that that's going on. But if everybody will scare or haze the coyotes and put a healthy fear of humans in them, then when the coyotes see humans or pet dogs or something like that, then their natural response is to move away from us.
And thanks, Valerie, very much for that call. I appreciate your call. As long as we're talking about coyotes, you've got an urban canid project that we've talked about in the past on the show, but how about an update on that, David?
Yeah, we'd be glad to. So our UW Urban Canid Project is going strong. We've caught 7 coyotes this year so far and 1 fox, and I know that doesn't sound...
And now this is right in the urban area.
Yeah, this is right here in the city of Madison, and I know it doesn't sound like a lot of animals, but if you think about the effort we put in, that's a heck of a lot of animals. So this year, what we're doing, every animal we catch, we're actually putting global positioning satellite collars on them, or global positioning system or satellite collars on them. So in years past, we had a different type of collar on there that we actually had to go out and locate the animal physically, and we got 5 locations a week on each animal. With these satellite collars, we get 8 locations a night on every coyote and 4 locations a night on every fox. So for the coyotes, and essentially in 2 months, we get as many locations as we would get in a year with the old collars. And so that's something that we've really enjoyed watching, where they're going. And it's been very surprising to see, with more refined spatial data, about where they're actually going. They're still staying generally in the same areas, but the amount of movement that they're doing is really incredible. And one of the things we're trying to figure out a little bit more now is we were able to demonstrate that coyotes and fox actually coexist in the same space and time here in an urban landscape, which is very unusual relative to non-urban areas. So we're trying to understand a little bit more about those interactions and things like that. So we are still trying to trap fox, and we live trap all the animals. We don't kill any of the animals. We live trap them, put a radio collar on them. We've got proper permits to do all of this and approval to do all of this. So if you do see a fox or a coyote in the city of Madison, we'd like you to go to our iNaturalist page. So you can just Google iNaturalist and UW Urban Canid Project, and it will pop up. And we'd love for you to report any of your sightings. And if you are seeing red fox in your yard or in your neighborhood on a regular basis, so maybe if you're seeing them at least once a week, if you would get in touch with me via email, I'd be very interested in finding out where those fox are.
There you go. So something else to keep your eye out for. Jan in Appleton, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jan.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I was out cross-country skiing after the deep freeze, and I was thinking, wouldn't it be nice to build something for the deer to stay in and be, I just don't know if they would all go in there and stay warm, or is it a waste of time?
Oh, a shelter. Well, you know, they find their shelter probably in the woods more than anything.
Jamie, do you want to comment on this?
Sure, that's fine. So Jan, I understand the empathy and the concern for wildlife, but as we talked earlier in the show, they are so adapted to being where they are. They'll find conifers, cedar swamps, places where they can get out of the wind and the cooler temperatures. They'll bed down. They've got hollow fur that provides an insulating coat. They add a different coat in the winter that they then shed in the summer. They're built to be in that environment. The issue with trying or having that empathy, but then maybe deciding you want to feed them or provide a shelter, is that you start to habituate them either to an alternative food source, which may not be as healthy as their natural food, the way their body has, you know, accustomed to live, or get them habituated to structures or finding shelter in more man-made type buildings or so on. So really in their best interest is to provide that habitat, so the native trees and shrubs that we mentioned, the conifer shelter belts or places for them to be able to be out of the wind, and they'll be just fine.
All right.
Yeah, a couple other things really quick to add on to the already good points Jamie's mentioned is, you know, number one, deer also will yard up. So when it gets really cold, they'll huddle together, and that provides and conserves a lot of heat for them. And typically, the larger you are as an animal, the easier it is for you to retain heat. So, you know, a large animal like deer, even though it gets really, really cold, they do a pretty good job of generating internal heat and keeping it within side of their body, just simply because of the size of that animal.
I have to drive quite often between Madison and Lake Mills on the interstate, and about two-thirds of the way to Lake Mills, on the south side of the road, there's a herd of, I see almost every day, probably 22 or 23 deer out there.
There's a farm field out there.
You see that same field.
I see the same thing.
Okay. There you go, Jan. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Dave in Clark County next. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
I know the National Park Service is planning on reintroducing wolves to Isle Royale to protect the moose up there. I'm wondering, have the wolves been studied with CWD in Wisconsin? Because if you overplace where CWD has found a map of that, and overplace where the wolves are, a map of where the wolves are, CWD doesn't seem very prevalent except deer game farms.
All right, wolves and CWD. So wolves, I don't believe hasn't been any research to show that they are affected by CWD, but I would guess that they would be more likely to take an animal that is injured or maybe sick from something like it?
Yeah, I suspect so. I mean, you know, they certainly, you always hear that predators are going to call out the weak and injured and sick and things like that. So possibly, Jamie, I'm not aware, at least, of any interspecific jumping where CWD has gone from deer to a different species that's not deer. So I don't know that that's been demonstrated in the literature that could even jump species.
I've been thinking that Dave might be thinking that it, as a way of controlling CWD.
Oh, I see.
Right. So I haven't seen anything in terms of it jumping into canines, you know, like the wolf. So if we're focusing on that, and I haven't seen any data, and I imagine it might be a sample size issue to look at whether they more frequently prey on animals infected with chronic wasting disease or not. That's a study that hasn't been done. But what we know from wolves is that they are very good at picking out differences that we wouldn't even necessarily notice to identify young and weak and go for them primarily for their prey species. So it would make sense, especially in the later stages of chronic wasting disease, that those animals might be more susceptible to wolf predation.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is, you know, CWD, it takes a while for it to manifest, to show up physically, so you actually know that that animal's got CWD. So, I mean, who knows how many deer are being taken that are CWD positive but are showing no outward signs of that at the time as well. So, yeah, that's a good question. Like Jamie said, I'm not aware of any research or literature that suggests one way or the other on that.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, though, Dave. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Call in with your wildlife question or maybe your experience to share. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Claire in Sauk County has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Larry. I want to ask your experts about mange. Where I live, there used to be a nice big pack, I guess is the word, of foxes in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And a few years back, they contracted mange and died off considerably. Now, every once in a while, I see one or two foxes throughout the course of a year. But I wondered, first of all, does it carry through generationally to their offspring and just keep going and going? Is there any cure for it? And do I have to worry about my dog picking it up?
Oh.
Yeah, so there's three different types of mange that are possible. The most common is sarcoptic mange, which is created or caused by a mite, an external parasite. Typically, we've seen mange in our study animals with red foxes and coyotes here in Madison, and I assumed that one of the reasons we were seeing mange, especially late winter, is because in the past couple of winters, again, as I mentioned, we've had pretty mild weather, and I just don't think that mite population has really gotten killed off, and so mange has been able to kind of persist through the winter, which is unusual if we have a really cold winter. Trying to develop a new research project with a colleague of mine, and we're looking at anticoagulant rodenticide exposure in fox and coyotes. And one of the things is that animals that are exposed to anticoagulant rodenticides, their immune system is lowered, and they are more susceptible to things like mange. So that might also be going on to kind of confound that. In terms of it going from generation to generation, it is very possible that the parents could expose the kits, the young fox, to mange simply because they're in a family group, especially when the kids are young. They're in a den with the mom, and because there's so much direct contact between the kits and the adults, that is very, very possible those mites could jump from the adult to the kit. So it is possible for some transgenerational exposure there. And in terms of your dog getting it, that would be very, very unlikely unless your dog is being directly and exposed to those mangy animals over extended periods of time. And then last thing, I think you asked about treatment. So you can treat mange, and typically, if I recall, it's treated with Ah, shoot, I can't recall that now. So it's the same drug that typically you'd give your animal for your pet for heartworm, I believe. But the issue with that is you have to treat the animal multiple times over, I think, a 2 or 3 week period. So you actually have to hold that animal in captivity, which is what makes it difficult to treat free-ranging wild animals.
Well, there we go. Thanks so much for that question. Appreciate your question there. Talking today with David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and the UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in. David and Jamie are both with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and David also UW Extension Wildlife Specialist. So great to have them with us. And join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Pete in Reedsburg emailed that the recent discovery of the West Nile virus in rough grouse is concerning to him and for a heck of a lot of people, actually. Is there a health issue with people possibly consuming infected birds? Will we face a problem with grouse similar to what we have with CWD and deer? You know, the fear of infection that might result from contact or consumption of the infected animal, will that keep hunters at home? Lots of interesting things, and I'm glad you brought it up, Pete, because I know we wanted to address it today. Let's go to Jamie Knack for us a response.
So, Pete, I'll just give a little update here on some press releases that the Department of Natural Resources put out, too, with some early findings. But to provide some background on this, we monitor the rough grouse population through spring drumming counts. And I guess I should back up. Grouse are a cyclic species, so they cycle about every 9 to 11 years in Wisconsin. And we were not expecting that to be at the lower point of the cycle these last few years, and yet some of the survey data showed a reduction in the number of grouse. So while we had spring drumming counts in 2017 were up, as we would have expected, when it came to the spring 2018 counts, there was a 34% drop. So that raised some concern, and just anecdotal evidence from the field, hunters were expressing concern over the number of birds they were seeing that particular fall of fall as well. So there was also some evidence that West Nile virus was showing up in Pennsylvania, and I'm not sure if it was Michigan or Minnesota, David, you may recall. But we got together with three states, so Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin, to just increase sample size, but to get test kits in the hands of hunters that could submit samples of harvested grouse so we could look to see whether West Nile virus was showing up. And the first results have come back from 16 rough grouse that were found sick or dead and submitted to the by the public to DNR from about October through December of this past year, 2018. And that confirmed that of those 16 birds, 10 were negative for any viral infection, 3 tested positive for Eastern equine encephalitis virus, 1 was positive for West Nile virus, and 2 were positive for both the equine and West Nile virus. So essentially 3 of those 16 birds showed West Nile virus. Now a little background, the equine encephalitis, that is something that is considered a native virus in Wisconsin. It was first detected in the grouse population in the late 1950s, and historical information suggests that the likelihood of that virus having a population level impact on grouse is believed to be low. And as far as the West Nile virus has spread from the eastern part of the country west. It's something that we see having an impact, certainly, or impacts corvids, blue jays and crows can show up in humans as well. You can go to the Wisconsin Centers for Disease Control website and take a look at both
human infection and infection in animals that have been tested or wildlife that have been tested. But from 2002 until 2008, there were only 8 grouse that had been tested in the state. So these are grouse that people find and, you know, wonder, you know, what happened to them because there wasn't a hunting season and happened to be tested. All were negative. But now with a more targeted effort, of those 16, 3 came back showing that they had the virus. That doesn't mean they died from that virus. It just means that they, you know, were, at the very least, were a carrier for that virus. So now we're kind of in a point of gathering information. And we don't know with science that there's a population effect from West Nile virus or that that's causing any issues. The bay or the season report from hunters has been very mixed. Some have said it was a great season. Some have said they felt there were fewer birds. But essentially, the 3 states got together and said we need to look into this more. And so they were looking for some more grouse to test. So the 2018 testing program between those 3 states, in Wisconsin, there were 238 hunter-harvested grouse samples that were submitted for testing of West Nile virus, and around that number, a couple hundred from each of the other states. That information is not hasn't been processed yet. They're expecting that data to come out, I've heard, late summer. And that will give us more of a sample size to see what may or may not be going on. And so when you talk to wildlife biologists, the Rough Grouse Society and so on, you know, our focus is really to think about habitat management for grouse as being the best method to mitigate any potential disease impacts on the population. So we really don't have a definitive answer if there even is a problem with the population. But I would say one very positive thing coming out of this whole issue being arisen, being discussed, is that the Department of Natural Resources is now working with partners to develop a long-term management plan for rough grouse. And that will be the first management plan for that species that the state has written. And that's scheduled to be completed in 2020. And so I think that's very positive to learn more about rough grouse.
What about the What about the question relating to can you
the eating?
Yes.
Consumption. Yeah. So it's been a while since I've been on that website. I'm going from memory here. When West Nile virus was really a hot topic and we were talking about it. If you go to the Center for Disease Control website, there was a fact sheet of frequently asked questions, and one of them was about consumption. And what I recall on that is there were a number of game birds that showed the virus, you know, that tested positive for the virus, and then there was concern by hunters and consumption. And I don't believe through proper cooking techniques that there's an issue there. And, David, I don't know if you have that.
Yeah, that's what I recall as well, Jamie.
So if you prepare the bird as you normally would, it's going to be roasted or whatever. You're not going to have an issue.
Yeah, but Jamie's right. Go to just double check with the Center for Disease Control and go to their website and double check that if you have any concern.
Yeah. All right. Good response, Jamie. Thank you very much. We have time for another. Let's go to Wayne. I think is up next. Wayne in Menominee Falls. Hello. Wayne, are you there? Maybe we lost Wayne. Let's try Jim in Madison then. Jim, hello.
Hello. I got a quick comment question. I guess more of a question. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported on a story that CWD was being caused by game farms and that the USDA and the state, I don't know if it was the DNR or not, but was withholding that information. And the story was pretty conclusive that CWD is breaking out when deer escape from these game farms. Is there any legislation going to stop these game farms from destroying our herd?
Jamie,
so first of all, I don't think there is any. I have not seen. This was something early on when CWD was discovered, as everybody wanted to know, well, how did it get here? And so fingers were pointed, but pointed in both directions. Captive servid facilities would point to wild deer. Folks managing wild deer would point to the captive servid. simply, as far as I know, we have no conclusive evidence of where it came from. And honestly, looking back isn't maybe necessarily going to be all that helpful. But in terms of regulating captive cervid farms, that falls on the Department of Agriculture rather than the Department of Natural Resources. So that's the Department of Ag. And again, I'm not sure what, if any, legislation is in there. There's been some movement in terms of double fencing and requirements on double fencing farms, and some options to cervid farm owners in how they meet that regulation or that requirement.
Yeah, and I think if it's discovered on a farm,
yeah, they'll depopulate that farm. So that's another depopulates another euphemism for killing. So that we've talked about earlier. But they'll come in and depopulate the farm for sure.
Yeah.
All right. So there you go, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Is dumping gut piles in the woods from CWD-positive deer, does that increase the spread of the disease? Ken in Browntown wants to know.
I don't know that I've seen any literature on that either from a science-based standpoint. The prions that create or cause CWD, it's a kind of a brain protein that's gone awry. So the prions, they can live in the soil for a long time and actually infect deer is what the thought is. But most of the prions are in the brain and in the lymph node system. So I don't know how much of that prion actually gets absorbed in the gut. Jamie, do you have any thought on that?
Well, I guess a couple other observations, but we certainly have trail camera pictures of deer investigating dead deer or a gut pile. So whether it be a roadkill deer laying there and decomposing or a gut pile from a hunter-harvested deer, they certainly can come in contact. So there is that contact. There is that potential for environmental contamination. I'm not sure, how hard the science is there or what research has been done, but this is where that whole discussion on carcass movement and transportation is working around is what are we going to do with carcasses that come from chronic waste and disease affected counties and whether they're transferred to other counties that are affected or they need to stay in that existing county. So I think more discussion on this is on the horizon.
We are going to take a quick break to take a look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And then we'll be back with David Drake and Jamie Nack. They'll be with us right up till 12:30. So you stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guests today, taking a look at the world of wildlife, David Drake and Jamie Nack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. David also with UW Extension, where he's a wildlife specialist. So great to have them along. Certainly, if you have questions about wildlife, we hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. And before I forget about it, I wanted to mention the 4th annual Sturgeon Spectacular is underway right now. It's February 5th through the 10th. It's a lot of fun. They have snow sailing competitions, downtown curling, a fun spiel. They have a sturgeon art show. There's some snow sculpting on Saturday. Winner goes to the National Snow Sculpting Championship. Concerts, there's a whole lot going on. And if you go to sturgeonspectacular.com, the Lake Winnebago area, sturgeonspectacular.com, and you're looking for something to do. It's a fun event for sure, something for the whole family. Well, we have a number of people with questions for you guys. Keith in Tripoli has a question, so let's go there. Keith, hello.
My question is I have 60 acres, and I don't allow anyone to hunt grouse on my property.
Okay.
And I can go out there. Every time I go out for a walk, I can always flush up a bird. Now, am I doing the population any good or am I hurting this population by not allowing it?
All right.
Jamie, do you want to start or do you want me to?
You know, I would say probably you're not hurting it. You're not necessarily helping it either. So hunting in that scenario is probably not additive in terms of the predation that, you know, how that animal would die otherwise. So I believe it's about 30% of the annual population. I wish I had those numbers in front of me, but in terms of how much of the annual, what the turnover is, 30% of those animals. So the question begs then, by adding hunting pressure, do you have additional mortality? And I think with good habitat, it's not additive mortality, it's compensatory in that rather than that grouse dying from being predated, it's dying from being hunted. So I guess to frame that up, if you're managing for rough grouse habitat, which is a species that needs a variety of age classes, but specifically early successional stages, and you have a harvest management plan for that property, you're doing just fine in terms of grouse management, and that population should be able to sustain some hunting pressure.
All right. There you go, Keith. Thank you so much for calling. Maddie and DePere will go to you next. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. I have two questions.
Okay.
I hope you can answer them fully. When you check for chronic wasting disease, are you checking for holes in the brain or are you checking for the glands? And if so, how long would it take for the deer to have that disease before it would show? That's one question. And the question in number two, you know, you indicated that when these trapped deer in these game farms get chronic wasting disease and they kill all of them, could you give us an estimate of how much that has cost the Wisconsin taxpayers? Because I'm sure those people are reimbursed. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Jamie, do you want to start?
Sure. I'll start. Hopefully get up most of these questions here. I tried to make a note. So as far as the lymph nodes and how we test for chronic wasting disease, those deer are brought, they're either brought to kiosks where the head is left with hunter information filled out on a form, and the state then has employees that remove the lymph nodes, and those are cross-sectioned and prepared and shipped off. And yes, you're correct, they're looking to identify the holes or that spongy appearance within the cross-section of the lymph nodes following standardized protocol, kind of the what's been held as the best science out there, you know, to make those determinations. So that's done by the researchers and so on. So that's how it's tested. As far as the captive facilities, the question was about the repayment or the
compensation.
Yeah, the compensation. Thanks. Those game farm owners or cervid farm owners are compensated for that loss. And to get that number that you're asking for, I have seen it published. I don't have it in front of me. This is something that's done, you know, has been done on a fairly regular basis. So if you're looking for a total payout, it depends on, you know, how far back you want to look in the records, but you should be able to get that information through the Department of Ag. You may see some of that information provided on the Department of Natural Resources website in terms of what those payouts have been. But that's public information. That's available. And they do receive a payout or compensation for the loss of that, revenue through the herd.
Do we know, as the other part of her question related to the length of time before it, that a deer might have CWD before it would actually pop up in the...
So it is possible to see through testing. I think they have shown or have had fawns test positive. So at the age of harvest, they're probably 6 months old, roughly 6 months old. But that's through testing. I think for the clinical signs, I think it's something around 12 to 18 months, sometime in that time period, before you see the clinical progression of the disease.
Okay.
Yeah, and the only other thing I was going to mention is, the game farms are clearly compensated for their loss, but if those deer got out of the game farm, which they do commonly escape from the game farm, if they get out and then get into the population, you know, there is a tremendous boost to the Wisconsin state economy from deer hunting every single year. And so it's one thing to look at just what is the compensation from the state for depopulating the game farm, but the true complete picture would be looking at what's the impact to the economy from decreased deer hunting if those deer get out and continue to spread CWD across the landscape further than what it actually is. So a more, I think, nuanced or balanced picture would be necessary to actually truly fully understand the cost to the state of depopulating and compensating the game farms.
Let's take another call. Joe in Richland, it's your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I have a couple trivial questions about animals that I have trapped in my shed.
Okay.
I feed wild cats in my shed. And I also trap skunks and possums. I've been on the land here for 46 years, and I'm very familiar with these cute little possums with their ugly teeth and, you know, being pink and gray. But in the last couple of years, I've seen possums that are black and gray, and they seem to be much more aggressive. I've trapped in one night, I caught one pink and gray one black and gray one. I took them out, released them. The pink one ran off into the woods like they all do. The black one walked about 3 feet and turned around and stared me down. Okay, my second question was a skunk that I trapped. I came out to the shed and immediately smelled the skunk. I went back in the house, came out a half hour later, and I could not smell the skunk. Can the skunk do something to neutralize its own smell?
Oh, interesting.
All right, so a couple of things. I'm going to start with the very first thing you said, Joe, before we get to your questions. If you can please stop feeding the feral cats, and if you can actually keep the cats indoors or bring them to a kind of a domestic pet center or something like that, simply because by feeding them, you're actually drawing more cats in because you're providing an attractant in terms of food. And free-ranging cats are terribly, terribly destructive to free-ranging wildlife populations, in particular birds, small mammals, reptiles, things like that. So so that's my one,
challenge.
Polite request is if you could stop feeding them, at the very least stop feeding them, and if you can collect them and bring them inside some place and not let them out, that would be ideal. Okay, so in terms of the possum, you know, it is most likely what's going on is that you have a different gene in the pelage coat of those possums. So as you correctly identified, most possums are kind of a pink nose, more of a gray grizzled coat. But, you know, just think about people or think about wolves. Sometimes you get a gray wolf. Sometimes you get a wolf that's all black. You know, sometimes you get wolves that are a little bit lighter colored, more tan in their pelt. So it depends on what the gene is and the dominant gene in that breeding pair. And that's what's developing that coat color. So that's probably what's going on with when you're seeing a darker gray possum, is it's not necessarily breeding with a skunk. It's just it's a different gene is being introduced into that pool there, into the genetic pool. And skunks cannot neutralize their odor. So the skunks are in the weasel family. They obviously have got the most developed scent sac there of all the weasels. And so, but what might be happening in your barn is either there's some wind that's coming, some kind of a wind current that came through within a half an hour. That's enough time a lot of times to clear that space out, or it got absorbed in something else, or whatever the case might be. But once they spray, they can't take it back, and they don't go around with Febreze and you know de-scentify the area.
There we go, Joe. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see, who have we got next here? Rose from Cross Plains, it's your turn. Hi, Rose.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I had a question. Our sons have the cameras out in the woods, and when we were reviewing some of the photos last weekend of the deer that have been in the area,
yeah,
there are two deer that had coats that were just very bad looking. I mean, it was so obvious there was something wrong with them. And we were curious, is there something we're supposed to report to the DNR when we see that?
Go on.
That,
just
recently or when? So I realized you took the camera cards in and we're taking a look at them, but when were the pictures actually taken?
I would say probably late December. And I also wanted to mention to you, our son's got two really nice bucks this year, and they looked very healthy, and they both had CWD.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And that is not uncommon. Most of the times when you ask hunters to report their any clinical signs or how the deer looked, 80% of the time they look healthy. They'd have no indication that they were diseased or had CWD. Well, I think David and I would be happy to take a look at those photos to give you a better indication, but it's hard to say without looking at them. A lot of times we have folks report from cameras concern about deer hides and how they look because they're actually going through the process of shedding that winter hide into summer. So it would be too early for that. That's not what I would expect. But we can certainly take a look at it. And if it is severe enough, these are the types of things that, yeah, reporting them to the local DNR field office or biologist, it certainly can't hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. And something is fairly easy to send those photos along.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Rose, does that help?
It does help. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, the number. Mike in Kokana, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I have a question. We live on the edge of town in the Fox Valley and on a cul-de-sac with heavily wooded area and lots of ravines and rolling hills. Periodically, we will see a fox. Many times we see deer and turkey and so on, but the last 2 days, we've had two fox that have been directly behind our house that I've never seen before, and they've been kind of just hanging around. And we had, of course, had extremely cold weather last week, and then we had the rain following. I'm just wondering, is it possible they might have had a den in one of the ravines that got flooded out or something? Because they hung around in the backyard for like 2 days, and now they're gone again.
Well, Mike, it is the Fox Valley, after all, so you need to expect a couple of fox. Were they red fox or gray fox?
They were red.
Red fox, yeah. So red fox right now are also breeding, and probably by the end of this month into March, they'll start having kits. So, you know, they also have, they operate in family groups. They've got territories they defend, and they'll kind of move around the territory. So it might be that they are regularly moving through your area, and you just don't see them because you're not looking out at the same time they're moving through the yard. They might be searching for some new den sites. They do have multiple den sites within their family territory that they'll move the kits from one den site to the next. So if one den site gets destroyed for some reason or is unusable for whatever reason, they have other den sites, or if there's a fear of predation, or if there's an increase in, you know, ticks or mites or whatever the case is in that den, they can move those kits to other dens. So that might be going on. It's not abnormal for them to be, especially in the types of areas you just described, kind of on the edge of town. It's not abnormal to have fox in those areas. So they might just be going through their normal day, and you just so happen to be able to look outside at the same time they are passing through your yard.
All right. Thank you, Mike, for calling. Appreciate it. Jim in Stevens Point emailed to say he has a friend who's been watching a crow with an obviously injured wing struggle through the last few weeks. It has fed at her feeder located in a small town urban area. Could anything be done to repair that wing, or is that crow destined to live its life injured?
So, Jim, that observation, the fact that I don't know if your friend, if they have seen the crow fly, but that would be the first thing. I mean, animals can adapt to injuries and get along, but an injured wing is of concern, and I think this would be a good opportunity to call the local wildlife rehabilitator. So if you were to go to the Department of Natural Resources website and type in the keywords, keep wildlife wild, which is all about, you know, when do you intervene, what's normal behavior, but also has a resource list of wildlife rehabilitators in the state. And you can look at the one that would be closest to your area and give them a call, report what you're seeing. And they are
both licensed and trained to handle wildlife. So we, as private individuals, without the licensing, cannot hang on to wild animals for more than 24 hours as we get them to the care they need. So give them a call, review what you're seeing, and then see how they'd like to handle it.
All right, there we go. Let's go to Rudy in Pewaukee next. Hi, Rudy.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So my wife and I, we always feed the birds, and we've noticed since the below-zero weather, we haven't seen any birds come to our feeders. We were wondering what's going on with that.
Well, if they were smart, they flew south.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's likely that the birds may be at your feeders still. Again, just as we talked about with that fox, you know, it just may be that they're at the feeders when you're not looking out the window or you're not available to see them. They may have found a different food source, and they're just utilizing that food source. And as long as that food source is abundant enough, they don't need to come to your feeder. Or they may, you know, have moved to more of a microclimate area for a brief period of time, whatever the case might be. I'm guessing they're still in the area. They're probably in your yard still. You just may not be seeing them. But I suspect that they'll be back.
I'm guessing the same. Thank you very much for that call. Appreciate your call. You've got a, there's a two-part workshop on estate and succession planning for family woodland owners. You're familiar with that?
Yep, I am familiar with it, but not nearly as familiar with it as Jamie is.
All right, Jamie, do you want to talk about that?
I would love to. Thanks for the opportunity. So myself and Chris Tiles, who's a natural resource educator, both of us with UW Extension, have seen the need and have had landowners asking, but to really put together a workshop that focuses on estate and succession planning for woodland owners. The goal here is having a plan for passing their property from one generation to the next, helping them through the legal and emotional process that you go through to do that. So the two sessions, we have the first session will involve bringing in specialists, so way above my knowledge, but estate attorneys, land trust representatives, and certified public accountants to provide some of that background, that information on what options they have. And then the second session, which we split these about 2 weeks apart so they can go back and talk with their families and have conversations, but the second is really talking about that succession planning, which is how do we have these difficult conversations, how do we decide who the heirs are, and certainly if there's multiple heirs, how do we divide things equitably, which might not always be equally. So with that being said, we're doing three workshops this year. We're doing one in the Oshkosh area, Delafield, and Ashland, and we are very interested in getting woodland owners and their families to these properties or to these workshops to learn more about the succession of their own properties. You might be asking why myself as a wildlife educator am interested in this, but if you think about private property and wildlife being a public resource, it behooves us to reach out to these landowners and try to keep these properties contiguous and not have them further fragmented. So for more information, these workshops are called Your Land, Your Legacy. And if you go to the following website, woodlandinfo.org, you can click under events, and there'll be other landowner workshops available too to take a look at. But this one will be under there on estate and succession planning. So again, that's woodlandinfo.org.
And it's I think it's $75 for two family members and $15 for each additional member. So for all the information you get, that's a pretty good deal.
It's a bargain.
It is.
Yes, and that money involves dinner both sessions. So I mean, where can you get dinner for two people twice for $75? So we're really trying to get people there.
Jamie and David, thank you so much for being with us today. We'll look forward to your next visit. You're back March 6th, and we'll do it all over again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. David Drake and Jamie Knack are with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. David, also a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist. Great to have them with us, and they'll be back on March 6th. Tomorrow, we'll talk with our consumer protection experts about the top 10 consumer complaints of 2018. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.